This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org.
All right. Good evening, everybody. This is Nate G. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing today?
Good. Good to hear you.
Good to hear you, too. So last week, we had a really fun show about James Damore and the Google memo controversy, and we went over kind of the entire memo and a couple of different points here. And so we got a couple of comments here, some good, some were kind of curious to know a little bit more. So Dr. Yeah. Lyle, tell us about what you thought about all this stuff that's come out so far from this memo.
Yes. One thing that came up is that, of course, I got a highly intelligent email from a highly intelligent woman who then presented me with a bunch of data that I was not aware of. And the data indicates that apparently there's been large meta-analyses, which is a scientific technique invented in, I think it was the 1960s, for compiling studies so that you get a much clearer picture than doing it study by study. And apparently there's little, if any, differences between males and females in mathematical abilities, which was surprising to me because that was new information for me. And, of course, that would have been different than – so what was this guy's name again?
James Damore.
Damore. I can't remember his name. Anyway, he was looking at, I'm sure, the same data that I had been looking at and that many people have looked at, so he might not have been aware of this. And also, ever since, for quite a while, the balancing view has been that verbal abilities of females are superior. And so it made perfect sense to me that males might have mathematical abilities that would be superior because they have somewhat different problems in their natural history than females, and that females might have somewhat better verbal abilities for the problems that they face. And so that all made sense to me, and I didn't give it too much thought other than the fact that I wasn't scandalized by the fact that there would be such differences, and that it made sense to me that such differences could play out in a modern environment in a way that could be striking and interesting sociologically. The Stone Age, people didn't evolve differences in the Stone Age 500,000 years ago aiming at modern culture and modern society. So the fact that there could be individual differences that would play out in the marketplace today would just be historical accident and sort of interesting. And of course, when there's economic implications, there could be, you know, cultural implications, et cetera. But this could be all just innocent luck of the draw genetically. Now, it is when I went back this week and then looked at this, I had to realize, you know, I'm not really sure what the answer is yet. I further looked at further evidence that indicated that some specific types of math problems. It may be that the males have a fairly substantial superiority, and those types of math problems could be three-dimensional geometric kinds of problems. That may or may not be true, but there's quite a few studies that show that kind of difference. Now, it's also true that as you start to look deeper into where females are superior, you start to find some other things, like, for example, facial recognition. Females are quite a bit superior at facial recognition. So you start to see evidence that certain verbal capabilities. So you start to see evidence of the following. I think this is, if I had a crystal ball, I would predict that this is what the next 10 or 20 years of research is going to show. I could be wrong, of course. And 10 or 20 years from now, I can make this statement now and nobody will remember that I made the statement. So I could safely make the statement and appear very sage in making it. But this is what I think. You know, I've thought back on my own histories from the very first time I was learning about intelligence testing in the early 1980s. And then performed many intelligence tests and read quite a bit of evidence on intelligence. What now I'm suspecting the case is that probably what you're going to find is that the male and female brains in evolution faced extremely similar problems, so that they should be very similar in their abilities. And in fact, overall, if we sample enough types of problems, we find out that there's no difference in intelligence if we get a wide enough sample. Now, we got another problem, though, and that is that if we group the problems in large amounts, like we say, quote, verbal versus math, the problem is that is likely to be too general. And so that instead what we're going to find is that there's going to be clusters of specialized neural circuits where on average there's going to be a great deal of individual variation here that's going to completely overwhelm the sex differences variation, of course. But I believe that you're going to find that the male human across the last 2 million years, as the brain evolved, faced slightly different types of problems than the female did. And the females obviously face slightly different problems than the male did. And you're going to find that where they face the identical problems, they have the identical abilities. And where they face slightly different problems, you're going to find that the sexes differ in those areas slightly, probably not dramatically, because the problems weren't so sexually stereotyped that there wouldn't be considerable overlap on the cognitive demands. Now, so I'm betting that you're going to find the three-dimensional rotational differences are came up to, on average across many studies, came out to about half a standard deviation. That's a lot. So that's about the difference of, call it from the 50th to the 65th percentile. So we'd have to look it up in a chart, and it depends on where in the bell curve you're talking. But it's more or less, call it 15 percentile points. Now, that may or may not be genetic, but I'll bet you that it's there, and I'll bet you that it's there to the tune of at least 5 percentile points. Now, 5 percentile points may have people shrugging their shoulders, but that is not trivial, and it is showing a evolutionary history of two bell curves that are not lying on top of each other, that the males would be slightly shifted to the right and a little bit higher on that type of problem, and females would be slightly shifted to the right and higher on problems of, for example, facial recognition, which may be more important for females in an adaptive setting, in a natural setting, than they are for males. So this is, I think that what we're going to find, unfortunately, is that when you start having a huge cluster of types of problems that you, quote, call math, they are not, quote, math. And it isn't that simple as a math chip versus a verbal chip. It could be like 50 different little sub-problems. And on average across those 50, you may find a subgroup of problems that where the males definitely have an advantage and other problems where females definitely have an advantage. One of the early puzzling facts about the early intelligence tests, which actually remain in true today, is that they have math problems and verbal problems. And on the math problems, they have arithmetic, and they also have memory for numbers, and they also have geometric problems, et cetera. And it turns out that the arithmetic problems actually, people's scores on the arithmetic subtest actually correlate better with the verbal scores than they do with the math scores. So it's starting to tell us that, wait a second, what we categorize, quote, as math is actually a very gross category of problems of which they're highly heterogeneous. And the same thing is likely to be true of what we, quote, call verbal, that a lot of those problems are social and some of those problems are less social, but they evolve a heterogeneous set of different kinds of problems. This would be why a meta-analysis could wind up obscuring individual differences, even though everybody thinks a meta-analysis is the ultimate way to test a hypothesis. But it is not an ultimate way to test a hypothesis. It's if you have studies that are all studying exactly the same thing over and over again, then a meta-analysis is good. But if you have 47 different ways, or in this case, 900 different ways of measuring what you call, quote, math and what you call verbal, then when you average across those domains, it could easily be that the male and female brain, if you group a wide variety of those, you're not going to find the differences. But when you go in and circuit by circuit look for specific things, you start to find it, which is exactly what some of these studies have, of course, found. When you go after just rotation of objects in three-dimensional space, now you start to pick up very robust differences. But if you then group that with two-dimensional geometry and with arithmetic, it all gets wiped out. So the one comment here could be that certain kinds of problems in the modern environment are best solved by highly specified circuits that, that, for example, may reside in either the male or female brain, particularly, for example, certain engineering problems. So certain engineering problems could easily be the case that the male brain is sitting at the 60th percentile, maybe, relative to the female brain. Now, that starts to be even a what you would call a fairly modest difference can set up a sociological avalanche or a snowball that essentially people are designed to genetically niche pick and figure out where it is that they have advantages over their competitors and where they have disadvantages relative to their competitors. They stay away from those areas. So even a relatively slight difference could then wind up essentially encouraging certain people to drift a certain direction and other people to drift away from that direction. And you could, behind a fairly subtle, even a 55 percentile versus 50th percentile shift in that curve, for example, on an engineering-related circuit, could easily be enough for it to wind up that 80 or 90% of the people that are in that area of life making a living wind up being male. So this, and this could, in other words, this is an avalanche of a sociological phenomenon following a fairly subtle biological phenomenon. So anyway, the questions, but it's not as simple as I had sort of previously thought that it was. So it does look different than that, and I believe. And so anyway, I wanted to clarify that because the last thing I want anybody thinking is that that I'm a, what do you call it, some sexist that doesn't stay on top of the literature and has a very overly simplistic view of sex differences in cognition. Mm-hmm. All right?
Yeah, that makes sense. When I was, a long time ago, I read a book by, I think her name was Lou Anne Brizendine called The Female Brain.
Uh-huh.
And it was describing some of the differences in the female brain versus the male brain.
Mm-hmm.
Some of what you were talking about the women's ability to recognize facial cues, and she says the result mm-hmm. of this is mirror neurons, that women are just have more mm-hmm. mirror neurons in there. But not only mm-hmm. that is because they have more mirror neurons as children, as infants, they respond more when the adults come to them and ooh and ah at them. And so they respond more, so they get better, and they wrap the myelin sheath, and they wrap the myelin sheath, and they wrap the myelin sheath. More so mm-hmm. than guys. So mm-hmm. any similarity that men that the boys might have gets
yeah.
they get far behind really quickly because the adults don't really make a lot of facial expressions to the young boys when they're growing mm-hmm. up. So I wonder if it's possible to that whether or not there's differences, if there mm-hmm. aren't differences, men, as we've talked about before in the earlier podcast system, if the males have a lot more reason to try to display and practice a lot mm-hmm. of their abilities because of their status-seeking yeah. behavior, then
sure.
they've just wrapped way more myelin sheath. So they might appear to have much more differences than they actually do genetically. They just had more practice.
Very possible. Very possible. All good thinking, and we'll watch for but one thing I wanted to point out here was that to not necessarily be intimidated by, quote, the last word of a meta-analysis. A meta-analysis can be extremely useful, but can also obscure the legitimate findings of a study that narrows down its investigation to a narrow enough level and finds a real effect. And if we then group it with a bunch of other studies studying, quote, what we think is a homogeneous phenomenon but is really a heterogeneous problem, we wind up losing important data rather than gaining. So this is why we should not completely ignore some of the findings that have been found just because a big sloppy meta-analysis educates us that we can't throw everything in the same pot, average it out, and then wind up with the truth.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Very interesting.
So let's
yeah.
move on now and let's see what else
okay.
we got.
So, all right. So we got a couple of questions from listeners. One mm-hmm. of them has to do with doing good in the world and how much is enough, overbearing mm-hmm. parents, some sibling birth order, and whether it matters or not, and then facing mm-hmm. death. So with that, let's take it away. So dear Dr. Lyle,
all right.
I've been fortunate enough in my life as a result. And as a result, I feel that it's important for me to do good in the world. For the most part, I do okay in this regard. Work for a nonprofit. I'm an ethical vegan. I'm very involved in a progressive church. However, I struggle with feeling like I should be doing more good in the world, like ditching my remunerative job and dedicating my life to something that requires more sacrifice, for example. So I have trouble just being happy with where I am. When I'm doing something, I often feel like I should be doing something else that's somehow better for the world. There's a quote that captures my feeling quite well, which is that I'm torn between a desire to improve the world and a desire to enjoy the world. Mm-hmm. This makes it hard to plan my day. And I'm a real planner, always thinking about the next thing I should be doing. So what's your take on this?
This is a very good question. It's just great. And there's so many angles that we could talk about. So I'm going to start talking, and I'll probably miss and forget some things that we might talk about another day, and hopefully it spurs additional questions from other listeners. I would say, first of all, that I've had many epiphanies. So I'll tell you about one epiphany that I had. Once I was flying somewhere like a big shot to give a speech that I wasn't going to be paid much for to promote my book, which wouldn't sell much. And as I'm looking down over the San Francisco Bay Area, and there's 6 million people that live there, I realized that at best, you know, there was no way that 1% of the San Francisco Bay Area was ever going to read my book. Not a chance. Not only that, it wasn't going to even be a tenth of 1%, and in fact, it was more likely at best to be a hundredth of 1%, if that. That would be an extremely big success, and it was exceedingly unlikely. And so, I just sort of had that moment where you realize that you are an unbelievably tiny fraction of what's going on in this world. And I can remember also sometime after that, looking down at some little kid, and I'm standing in some line, and this little 3-year-old kid that has doting parents who are well-to-do, and the kid's got a big ice cream cone that he's licking. And, of course, I'm having my thoughts about that. And I also...
This is not carrot cake.
And I'm looking at this, and I'm looking at the general unbelievable... dietary indulgence of the United States relative to not only what happens in the third world, but also what has happened throughout human history. And realizing that a lot of my career has been about speaking to people about how to deal with and manage their own tendencies towards extraordinary dietary indulgence when they're trying not to, okay? What a bizarre, twisted, upside-down problem that is and how difficult it is to stop it. And when I realized that if I spent my life looking down at this little kid and toiled as hard as I possibly could and was just brilliant and had unbelievable impact on the world, if I did, my impact, positive impact on that child's existence would likely, there's no way it would be as much as 1/10 of 1%. Impossible. Steve Jobs has not had a 0.1% impact on anybody's life in the United States other than the people that work for him. Okay? No way. So no single human being is moving the needle. Not happening. The and that when I thought about that, I thought, well, why on earth toil into the night trying to make a huge difference in the world when all that would happen is that in a miracle this little guy's life would be 1% better? Why on earth would I care? His life is already indulgent beyond all belief. There's nothing that I'm going to do that is going to have a substantive impact on the world that's going to move this needle one bit. And so we need to get clear that the purpose of our life is not to make the world better. That's an interesting mistake that you can get trapped into. The purpose of your life is to enjoy your existence. That is the purpose. You keep that front and center. And now it's going to turn out that inside of you, what you have is you have happiness circuits. You just as you've got circuits that can smell carrots, and you have circuits that can feel ice if you put it on your knee, and you have circuits that can see flowers, and you have, in other words, you have all these phenomenal variants of experiences that you can have. Certain of those experiences will cause emotions as opposed to sensations. But of those experiences, what we are attempting to do, think of your nervous system as a jukebox, and what we're trying to do is we're trying to hit the hits. You're trying to hit the music that you really, really like. And the music you like causes a diverse set of experiences that we call happiness. And happiness can take place in various and sundry ways. The most common and most dominant features of the interactions between humans and their world that cause happiness circuits to fire are esteem signals. Okay, so that comes from us earning and then getting esteem signals from other people. Now, it's going to turn out that the desire then to earn esteem, you're trying to be valuable. And so you're trying to be valuable in the Stone Age in the village. And the village is pretty small, 30, 40, 50 people. And the genes are designed to compete to try to be valuable in that village. And when you compete successfully and demonstrate your value to the village, you will get esteem signals throughout your day and throughout your years that will indicate that you are valued, i.e. loved, in the village. Now, the problem is the modern environment is 7 billion people, not 35. And so what can happen is that the genes that build people, they come with some motivational architecture. One of them is going to be what I call hill climbing, and another one's going to be what we're going to call conscientiousness. So the hill climbing gene means to rise in dominance hierarchies, to become as spectacular and valuable as you can be in whatever way that you can until you get stopped by competitive superiority. So go get as high in the company as you can before you get stopped. Get as high in the Olympic sprinting as you can before you get stopped. So whatever it is that you're doing that tries to garner esteem from the village, rise until you get stopped. The problem is in the modern environment, if you've got a couple of characteristics, particularly conscientiousness and agreeableness, as this person is signaling by their life history, that they have those two things in spades. If you have those two things, then you have two-thirds of what I call the sucker medallion. And if you add intelligence to it, then you've got the triple play here, and you've got a medallion just about hanging around your neck. And that medallion is that if you are conscientious and agreeable and you're intelligent, the world will find you, and it will try to get you to do what it is they want to do. And in doing so, what can happen is that your own conscientiousness, which can drive hill climbing, can be highly associated with this, that we can essentially be spending a great deal of our energies climbing and demonstrating superiority at how much it is that we can give to the village. Now, you can see how in a Stone Age village, you would be keeping track a little more closely on the debits and credits that would be flowing back and forth and seeing whether it was worthwhile. You'd see where you were hitting the apex of your ability to rise higher in that domain, and then you would back off your energy. And you'd have so many other things in your life that were calling demands to you. You'd have a slew of children and relatives and people with problems, et cetera. So the point is a lot of this altruistic helpfulness would actually be directed at your own genes as opposed to the amorphous masses that it might be directed at today. So what's easy to happen is that it's easy to get your life out of balance, not hard to do. I think an example of a life that got out of balance, and I'll probably get some mail behind this, a classic example would be Mother Teresa. So I have no doubt that Mother Teresa was not only extremely conscientious, but probably very agreeable. And so you wind up, let's suppose that in principle, she's at the 99th percentile of both of those, which wouldn't surprise me. That would mean that statistically, you've got a 1 in 10,000 individual, which means you've got a rare individual. Now, some people would say that she had enlightenment, okay? I would say instead that what we had was a very unusual personality with a set of circumstances that led her to be essentially trapped by an unusual nervous system that wound up not able to sort of break out of that pattern. Now, it turns out, I'm not saying that she lived a lousy life. I hope she lived a great life. I hope she enjoyed it a great deal. But that doesn't make her enlightened. That makes her a genetically unusual specimen that when you start having that kind of a situation, you're very likely to wind up sacrificing your life to other people and other causes and wind up essentially with a life out of balance. And so if you are genetically unusual, it's easy for you to sort of get your life tipped out of balance. So think of that game of life as a set of circuits, happiness circuits that reside inside your head, and they are generally quiescent. Okay, they're just sitting there, just like the circuits in your head that can taste an orange. They're not going off hardly ever. Only when you taste an orange, your happiness circuits are sitting there quiet, able to be activated under certain experiences. And just like if you were to optimize your eating experiences, you would know that you wouldn't just eat brown rice and broccoli every day. You would actually have a diversity of experiences, and those experiences would rotate. They would change and shift and ebb and flow. That if you think in principle about the idea of optimizing your gustatory experience in life, you can see that it wouldn't be behind one thing, nor would it be behind two, nor would it be probably in a highly regular pattern. There would be an ebb and flow and change to how it is that would actually optimize your experience. The same thing is going to be true of the activities of life. So the activities of life are going to they're going to ebb and flow between not only earning esteem in the right way from the people that matter and receiving those signals, but it's also there's also going to be the quiet work that's done from earning your own self-esteem, as your self-esteem watches you quietly work to try to improve your own abilities. That's another process that takes place that isn't directly in the face of other people and the esteem signaling that they would give you. But it's also true that you are not only a producer of things to the village, you are also a consumer. And so you are also one who gives the esteem signals to others for their accomplishments and what they bring to the village. So you're not just a singer, you're also somebody that appreciates athletics. You're not just an athlete, you're someone that appreciates someone that defends the country. So in other words, we are both all, you know, producers if we can be, and we are also consumers of what it is that other people bring to the village. So our life, you know, to optimize the happiness circuits, we want to earn and enjoy credits from our contributions, and we also want to observe and express our appreciation for those others who are also bringing things to the village. So so therefore, it would be absurd to think, if you were to look at this on some kind of an interesting continuum, should I be working and toiling all day to work make the world a better place? Well, only if you happen to have some very, very bizarre circuits in your head. And even if you did have those bizarre circuits in your head, I would argue that they are probably not even, would never be as far out of balance in the Stone Age as they could get today. So I would say watch out for the save the world heroic circuit. Remember that in the end, all you have on this life is you've got time and experiences. And so you want to do good things to earn esteem from those that matter. Don't try to earn it from the whole world in some amorphous way. I believe that's a mistake. I myself will do isolated, altruistic sorts of acts, not generally, but very specifically. So I will, from time to time, come across individuals that I happen to like, that happen to be in some kind of a bind of some kind, and I will invest in those people. I'll invest my time or energy or occasionally money, and I like that process. And I think it's more rewarding to me personally rather than trying to lift the world 0.01%. It's better for me to lift one life, 100%. And so I think that I would give that as advice to anybody who is in this kind of dilemma. When you do that, the what you do to, quote, make the world a better place, forget the world. Think about your world. And trying to help a specific individual make their life better, could be anybody. But the great basketball coach said that, John Wooden said, that when you no longer care about the problems of the young, it's probably time for you to leave. And so in this way, there are always people that are struggling and worthy and hitting obstacles and could really use some help. And when you help them, when you reach down and reach across and help them, and they see what you did and they see that you didn't have to do it, the esteem that you earn from doing that on occasion, that's grand. And that's where I would put my energies in that department, rather than worrying about the whole world.
Like you always say, it's better to make a small decision than a big decision.
Yes. There you go.
All right.
Let's
Fantastic.
Move on.
Let's move on. Okay. Well, before we go on to the next questions, and we actually have a caller on hold here. So let's bring them on here and see what they have to say. Caller, how are you doing? What's your name and where are you calling from?
Hey, Nate and Doug, this is Rob again. Nate, I don't want to be a nuisance and call in every week, but, this is like a...
No worries.
I mean, people out there, you need to get with the program. I mean, you mean to tell me I can call in and talk to the one and only Doug Lyle for free? I mean, come on. Like...
Thank
you. Well,
the only one.
Google or Apple is going to, or the iTunes is going to start charging any minute now.
Yeah. All right, what's up, Rob?
Dr. Law, I was thinking, what is your response to someone who says, well, I'm kind of iffy about having kids, but maybe I should have kids because who's going to take care of me when I'm old?
Yeah, I think that's a very, very bizarre attitude. I would say that's probably not very well considered attitude. The children are an unbelievable investment in time and energy. I had a good friend of mine who contemplated having children, wanted children, and then had them. And she's a psychologist. And I asked her, I said, not having had children myself, I said, how is it? How's the workload? And she said, I underestimated it by 700%.
Wow.
In other words, it was a massive misread over the huge investment that was involved. So having children as a buffer zone against one's old age may make some kind of convoluted sense. But I would say instead, if one is concerned about that, then you do exactly what I just talked about, which is that when you are able and you are competent and you have something to give to the world because you're still a competent human, then it might be good to invest some altruistic effort in the young. And you might want to find specific individuals that are worthy human beings, that are highly conscientious, that might need some help and assistance. And you reach out to those people. And you reach out to those people. And then after you do that, you make connections with the next generation. Then what you do is you make sure that you have got yourself appropriately settled for your future financially. So you're not a financial burden on anybody, which means you produce more than you consume for an awful long time, so that you're in a position that if you have to be in your old age and in trouble, that you can consume a lot more than you produce at that time. And then you make sure that you've got somebody out there in the world that cares about you and loves you because you earned it, and that that individual can then look across your care and make decisions for you in case you get into trouble. So children as a financial insurance policy is absurd. And that shouldn't be done. People should just take it upon themselves to take care of business. And children as an emotional insurance policy are likewise absurd. Your children may hate your guts, okay? There is no guarantees of this. And so so this would not be a wise thing to do. You have children either by accident and then by moral stance that you can't terminate them, or you have children because you want to have children and you want to go through that process and do the investment and enjoyment process of the whole thing. But children for the process of having an old age buffer is one of the more ridiculous motivations that I can think of. And so I vote two thumbs down all by myself. All right.
All right.
All right.
Rob,
thank you.
Thank you very much for the call.
Thanks for calling, Rob.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks.
All right. Fantastic question.
All right.
And, Rob, we always appreciate repeat callers. So, okay, so moving on to the next question. This is about overbearing parents. So, dear Dr. Lyle, mm-hmm. I have a question regarding childhood experiences and how much nature versus nurture actually does affect us. My father was an overbearing and analytical person. Nothing was ever good enough. Get a B, why not a B plus? Get a B plus, why not an A? My mother was unaffectionate and irritable and always wanted a daughter. I became a people pleaser with low self-esteem no matter what my environment reflected. But I'm 6 feet, 180 pounds, muscles toned and fairly good looking, yet I never felt attractive even when women would approach me. I rebelled to my parents' demands, self-sabotaged my own self-success in life, and feel undeserving when I got any success. I would date women, they would fall for me, but the moment I noticed any emotional response, I would be immediately turned off. In a business meeting, when I speak and I notice everyone is actually paying attention to me, I actually feel awkward that I'm actually being heard rather than feel valued that my words are making an impact. My brother, on the other hand, is a self-serving narcissist who would never do anything against his own self-interest and would need to see personal gain for himself before ever helping anyone. Very analytical, financially conscious, and his time and resources are kept strictly guarded. Yet, he's extremely unhappy on the inside, bitter, irritable, and cold. So what happened here? How did we end up on two opposite sides of the spectrum? And how can I rationalize this to help me to move away from these self-sabotaging tendencies?
Well, God, it seems like we haven't answered this question, huh? It seems like we did. I would say, first of all, the first opening part of this question is sort of nature versus nurture. And I would say that my general take is as follows, that both of them have an enormous impact on your life experience. They do not both impact your personality. They both impact your life experience. So your own nature genetically has a tremendous impact on your life experience. If you are born not very bright, you could be born emotionally unstable. You could be born highly conscientious. You could be born a flake. In other words, these sorts of, you could be born very extroverted and very warm and friendly and pretty bright and everybody likes you. It's like you who you are genetically has an enormous impact on what your life experience is going to look like. It's also true that circumstances have a substantial impact on your life experience at any given time. So this person had a pretty rough go in the first 20 years of their life when their parents were front and center and their brother was front and center. So these three individuals had a lot of input on this individual's life. And as a result, I'm sure those times of that individual's life were, you know, pretty unhappy. So as a result, you know, now the question is, he goes on to say, well, I'm kind of awkward and uncertain and don't have high self-esteem even now. Okay. Well, and you know, was this caused by being, you know, beat up for 20 years inside my family? I doubt it. There would be other psychologists that would say absolutely, and we need to go in psychodynamic therapy, and we're going to unwind all these issues. And I would say, really, I actually don't see any research evidence that even remotely supports this. So more likely, we've got a family here with genes written all over it of some pretty unhappy people. Mother, you know, irritable and problematic and not warm to her son because she always wanted a daughter for some reason. And we got a father who is apparently just a pain in the ass, ego-trapping, you know, unhappy guy. Then the brother is, you know, these are all disagreeable, unhappy people. Now, our person sounds like he's more agreeable, but he's pretty unhappy. And so I think what you're seeing here is a lot of this person's suffering is actually due not to his upbringing, but to some circuits that he inherited. The reason I say this is, yeah, you can see this all over the monozygotic twin studies, that no matter what their parents were like or how they behaved, these kids 35 years later when they grew up, they're very similar in their personalities. So this is why it is that I believe what I believe about nature versus nurture. Now, what do we do about this? Well, now we're getting a little bit, we're asking a little bit too much of a general question and answer. So with a person like this, I would, when they say, well, I'm self-destructive or et cetera, well, I would need to know how are they self-destructive, in specific what domains, what are they thinking. I would need to know, you know, sort of what status are they defending in order to, you know, where are we getting the self-destructive behavior? Self-destructive behavior is a result of ego-trapping situations where it's simply the cost-benefit analysis is such that it's not worth trying your best because you could lose more status than the status that you have to gain. And that, you know, in some fashion, that is taking place when people are doing self-destructive behavior, unless the self-destructive behavior is having to do with some bizarre anomaly in the environment, like, you know, drugs and alcohol and pornography and gambling or whatever, you know, processed food. In other words, there are stimuli in the modern environment that disturb the situation between person and environment and cause self-destructive behavior. But that's different than what this guy's talking about. So anyway, my broad answer is this person was born with some sort of shaky circuits that were going to be were going to make life a challenge, and then spent 20 years not only with those circuits, but with the people that had those circuits and more that were actually colder and more disagreeable than this individual. Sounds like the brother bred true. In other words, the brother was a very good and representative outcome of those two parents, and our guy was not. Our guy's, the apple fell a little further from the tree, a little warmer, a little less, you know, not so self-assured, not so entitled, but has some other emotional characteristics that have made the life a challenge. So I would say that, you know, we would have to get more specific, and if they were to write to us again with something a little more specified, then I'll try to answer it then.
Fantastic. Okay, great.
Okay. All right.
All right. Next question. Dear Dr. Lyle, wanted to know your thoughts on sibling birth order. Some of the people closest to me are the baby of their family, and my observation has been that they seem substantially less resilient to the trials of life that they face. They seem to have a lower tolerance for problems and complain much more than people who were firstborn or among older siblings, whereas the older siblings I've observed seem to be more responsible and caretakers of the family. Is this just my imagination, or is it something to this? I'll tell you.
Yeah, go ahead.
I have two sisters, one older, one younger, and every time I meet new people, usually in a dating situation, it's they'll ask about my sisters, and they say, "Oh, so are these older, younger? Oh, you're the middle child. Oh, you're the middle child." I always wondered what that meant, so maybe you could clarify, because I looked it up everywhere which way, and it seems to be that middleborns just have a whole bunch of problems, according to all this pop psychology.
Yeah, right. Very nice question. Very, very common question in people seeking to understand personality. The people are designed with a brain seeking patterns. You're a pattern seeking machine. In fact, that's what brains are. Brains are literally devices seeking patterns, because what a pattern is, as opposed to sensory chaos, pattern actually indicates that there are correlation coefficients in the stimulus array that indicate statistical regularities that can be exploited. So there's more worms over there. There's more birds chirping over there. I feel to behind me, I feel vibrations, etc. In other words, literally what intelligence is the reduction of ambiguity. And so a pattern recognition is literally what a brain is doing. It's recognizing patterns so that it can act on those patterns to their advantage, be more effective in their movements. Otherwise, if there were not patterns in nature, there would be no brains. So at any rate, so people have been looking for patterns of human individual differences forever. And this is why you've got totems on a totem pole. So they look and say, well, you seem like you were tough as a kid, so your totem is the bear or whatever. Okay, so so across history, pattern recognitions have taken everything from the four humors of the body of ancient Greece to astrology to Jungian archetypes to the Enneagram. There's been one mistaken bunch of inferences after the next about what is the root of individual differences or the nature of individual differences. One of those is birth order. And so birth order is one of a long line of doomed hypotheses about individual differences. Now, unlike all of those other things, which are all completely have zero validity, birth order has a tiny bit of validity. The research evidence indicates some very small correlation coefficients on a few personality dimensions. These correlations are very small. They are so small that no human being could ever detect them. In other words, if you were to meet 100 second-born children and 100 third-born children and 100 first-born children, and you literally had a hotel, and in that hotel you had 100 first-born women and 100 second-born women and 100 third-born women in each of three ballrooms, and you went and hung out in those ballrooms and shook hands and listened to people's life stories, excluding family interactions and sibling interactions, and listened to their careers, and you spent 2 hours in each of those three rooms. At the end, if we had 50 of the top psychologists in the world in personality spend 2 hours in each of those rooms, and then we ask them, which room were the firstborns in, which room were the second and the third, they could not tell you. It's impossible. So there is no possible way. If you had 50 psychologists, their answers would be no different than random chance. So this individual, like everybody else, has seen, what, 5 or 10 families that they've thought about? That's nothing, okay? And it's it doesn't even begin to widen out the net large enough to actually look for these statistical regularities. The person has been now obviously that firstborn people in the family itself are going to be very often be in higher positions of authority and responsibility. So while those people are growing up, that can be true. But as soon as we look at them when they're 25 years old, forget it. Okay, that is gone off the chart, and everything has changed. So you will not find that the older people are, quote, more responsible than the younger people at that point. Not going to happen. So, yeah, this is a, like I said, just one of many thoughtful and interesting and potentially truthful ideas, just as astrology was a potentially truthful idea. People looking at the stars. The configuration of the stars has enormous predictability for the seasons, which has enormous predictability on crops, which has a very important impact on human life. It's reasonable that people looked at the stars to try to find evidence, to try to look for patterns of other things in human life that might be important. So, of course, in trying to solve the problem of personality, they looked very, very hard at the stars to see whether there's correlation coefficients with when people were born and what their personalities would be like. And when it didn't work, then astrology got more complicated to add more variables to fix it. And then when that didn't work, they added more variables to fix it. And then pretty soon, well, your rising sign is this and the other sign is that. So you're a little bit of that and a little bit of that. It's like it all seems to fit, okay? But all that's really you're seeing is the struggle of a human mind seeking a pattern, okay? And people will absolutely struggle to find patterns when they're not there, when they're desperate to try to find a pattern to reduce variance, to reduce their errors in making decisions. So stock market pickers are notorious, looking for, you know, pattern after pattern after pattern, desperately trying to find a pattern and coming up with all kinds of cockamamie ideas that fall apart as soon as you look at the evidence. So that's the answer to the story. Oh, yeah, just so you know, there's a tiny little bit of evidence. The effect sizes are unbelievably small, far too small for any human being to ever detect.
Mm-hmm.
You could it's like detecting the difference of the temperature between your left, your right forefinger and your left forefinger. Like, there can be a tenth of a degree difference, but you would never know it, okay? And that's what the personality differences are as they're related to birth order.
Yeah, when we first did the podcast about the personality statements, the personality differences, and you talked a little bit about astrology, and you said that the way astrology works is they make Barnum statements where they're so vague that anybody can apply them to anybody.
Right.
So I think 6 months ago or so, I again went on a date and I got the whole, you know, you're a middle child and blah, blah, blah.
Right.
So I decided to go and look up, what does this actually mean? So I found on parents.com, you know, they explain all these pop psychology problems and they have all these characteristics of the firstborn, the middleborn, and the last child. Because, you know, people only have 3 children. So, The first, you know, so there was like a bunch of adjectives that I just have the firstborn. I thought, you know, I'm going to use your, I'm going to use the logic that you gave us. And I tried to cover up and put them in an Excel sheet. So I couldn't tell which one was the firstborn, which one is the middle child adjective, and which was the last born. And it turns out they all apply to me. So, you know, there we go.
Very good. All right.
Yeah.
I'm proud of you.
All right,
what else we have?
All right, last question. We want to hear you talk, Dr. Lyle, about death. Why does it happen? What does the body go through? And how might we most skillfully prepare for it and face it? How do we best carry on after losing those we love? I've noticed that certain groups focused on health seem to convey a subtle message that death can somehow be vanquished or that we can have pain-free lives up to the last minute when we die in our sleep. And this seems to emphasize a certain braggadocio that may not be warranted. Love to hear your thoughts and musings on all of this.
Oh, really fine. Really fine. Really thoughtful. First of all, being, since I've died 17 times, I'm really knowledgeable about it. Okay. The it turns out that the nature of life, life is a process of integration of chemicals, and the complexity that is involved in keeping that integration is astronomical. It's vastly beyond anything that a human being could, you know, any group of human beings could ever imagine doing. So literally, the workings of a single cell are beyond the complexity of the entire world economy, probably by a factor of, you know, 10 million. So the so when you realize that you're made of trillions of cells, for God's sakes, you can, and that they're interrelated in a way to integrate into being you, you start to get a feel for just how outrageously complex a life form is. It's going to turn out that those complex integrations are living in contrast to the laws of entropy, which are pulling things apart into disorder. So life is order, and non-life is essentially disorder, is how this is going to work. And so you can only organize an entity to be so chemically stable to fight against the forces of entropy for so long, and then it's going to die. And it turns out that the nature of this process is that different life forms and their ability to do this are effectively equal. So the life processes of a frog and the life processes of a camel and of a human are all about the same. So they all have, however this works, there's like these, I don't know, logarithmic mathematical formulas that can say, well, it's this big and it has this many heartbeats and therefore it's going to live this long. And it's like unbelievably good. So you can tell that a human is going to live about 80 years and a chimp is going to live about 50 and a horse is going to live about such and such, et cetera. It's like, it's really clear how this all works. This is all basically cell biology. It's the nature of life. So that's that. There's no way to beat it. I have a good friend of mine, Dr. Alan Goldhammer, who's, you know, one of the three or four healthiest livers I've ever seen on in my time. And in other words, this guy, you know him, Nate, and you know that this guy is iron self-discipline and just an extraordinary, he's a health machine. And in the back of my mind, I always thought that my good friend Alan would figure out how to cheat death. And in fact, I thought he was so smart and such an amazing human being that I actually have believed most of my life that somehow he was going to do it. I said
we'll
to him
find
one
out
time, Alan,
75 years.
I really expect you to pull this off, and I'm really kind of counting on you. And, you know, it's starting to get late here. You know, we're getting older, and I'm more or less, you know, I'm tapping my foot, like, when are you going to figure this thing out? There is no figuring it out. And there's no stopping it in terms of preparing for it and facing it. I think it's useful. There's useful techniques that I will use in therapy to try to hold the mirror up to people psychologically. And different ways that I do this has different shock value to different persons. So when you say, well, you know, you probably got 30 years left, that doesn't do much. But some people, I'll say, you got 360 months. And they're like, oh, my God, I only have 360. I'll say, you've got about 1,000 weeks
more
left.
Summers.
Yeah, you got about, yes, exactly. You've only got so many more summers. And so to try to use numbers to hold up the fact that, you know what, we're going to die, and probably the last couple of years are going to be lousy. And the notion that this person says, you know, if you are super healthy, do you get to live to the last breath, et cetera, it ups your odds of living without pain and being in pretty good shape towards the very end. It doesn't guarantee anything. Human beings, if they take care of themselves, they're less likely to die of a disease process and more likely to simply die of old age, which is a different thing. And but there's no guarantees. So I'm sort of expecting that, and I'm trying to do a good job in this life, so probably I only have maybe 3 or 6 months of lousy at the end. And I'm going to try to, as my friend Alan said, Doug, there is no solution to this problem other than you get to try to live till you die.
Mm-hmm.
Try to do a good enough job with your health that you maintain high function into the majority of your life expectancy. And I have to say that that is probably truly the best motivation for trying to do a good job on your diet, eating a lot of fruits and vegetables and whole foods, getting regular exercise, getting to sleep on time, staying away from drugs and alcohol, et cetera. I mean, all these things are, no one of them is going to be a disaster, and no one thing is going to save you. But what you want to do is you want to minimize the chemical stresses on the body so that we don't wind up pounding the daylights out of something and then that winds up being the organ that fails on us. And then we wind up going out 10 years early and going out hard. So that's why I'm a believer in healthy living and to do a good job as far as that goes. But as far as the rest of it, I'm also a big believer in being a consumer in this life, not just a producer. This question ties in neatly to the question that we began the night with, is about sort of how to spend your life. And the answer is, the best defense against this problem is to realize the best way to prepare for the end of your life is to make sure you didn't waste the time that you had. Be real about trying to stop yourself from needless hill climbing and to try to focus on how do your personal happiness circuits work. And if you're not getting a lot of happiness circuits activated, then you've got some homework to do, which is vital. And you've got some experiments to run about how to change some of the parameters in how it is that you invest your time and energy in this life and find out if there are people or activities that you need to shrink down and other people and activities that you need to invest more in. And you want to find your way to the moods of happiness as consistently as possible. And that's what you want to do. And that's the best you want to, you know, as we age and as we lose our function, you know, you want to be able to look back and feel and remember that you didn't, you know, spend all this time in an office, to do what? To rise in a hierarchy, to make more money, to be in a corner office, to do something so that we could look fancier and get pseudo esteem from people that don't even know what the hell we did. Okay, no, that would be falling into the trap. We want to enjoy the process of interacting with people that we really like and enjoy doing things that feel valuable and interesting, and to try to enjoy the very much as you can out of the limited time that we've got.
Fantastic. Dr. Lyle, as always, love it, love it, love it. Well, have a good night, Dr. Lyle. We will talk to you next week.
Very good. Thank you, sir. We'll see you soon.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.